Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
On today's Fresnolandia, we are joined today by Keith Brookbold. He is the CEO of Regenerate California Innovation, and he's also the CEO of Better Blackstone CDC, or Community Development Corporation. He is a former planning director for the city of Fresno. He has a much longer resume than I am explaining right now. But if you are a person that touches planning and politics in Fresno, you've probably encountered Keith at some point. And today we're really excited to have Keith because we're going to have the first of a two-part series talking about the Southeast Development Area, also known as SEDA. And if you're a person that pays attention to Fresnoland and reads our newsletters or reads our site, you might have seen us reporting about this for the last 2 years. It's a 45,000 home mega development is the word we're giving it. That's just located outside of the boundaries of the city of Fresno in Southeast Fresno off of the 180. And there's a big debate happening in the public eye. You may have been following along. So we're really happy to talk to Keith to hear a little bit more about his thoughts on SEDA and why he's opposed to the project in particular. So welcome to the podcast, Keith.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you guys.
So I'll start with just a question about the history. And for those of, for people who don't know, Keith was working at the city as I believe initially the assistant planning director and then the planning director when an iteration
was there. I was never really the planning director. I was the acting director, the interim director a couple of times, and always the assistant planning director.
Okay, but you were there at City Hall when one of the iterations of SEDA, formerly known as SEGA, was active, and this is in the 2000s during the housing boom of the early 2000s. What's sort of the origins? Because I know Mayor Dyer actually referenced a bit ago that the origins of SEDA actually go to the 1950s. So where did this come from?
Well, I don't know about that history. I do know the history beginning in about 2006. I started working with Nick Yovino, the planning director, in July of 2006. Unfortunately, he had a heart attack in January of 2007, so then I was acting for a while, that kind of stuff. But Nick was part of the negotiation team in 2003 that negotiated a new MOU with the county, and LAFCO blessed it to actually include this 9,000-acre expansion in the Fresno sphere of influence officially. And part of the reason that this thing got started into the planning process was Nick really believed that we needed to generate some sort of a plan for that area to retain its presence in the SOI.
So, Keith, you used to be a supporter of SEDA. Why did that change?
Kind of is a long history, right? Maybe a couple of points really quickly to get back to origins, and I'll answer your question, Jordan. Nick started this conversation, and Larry Westerlund, then Councilman Larry Westerlund, recommended that we hire Peter Calthorpe, who's like the new urbanism guy in the world, right? And so that got started. This thing started rolling very early in my second tour of duty with the city. I had a first tour in 74, 75, so this was my second tour of duty. And frankly, just wanted to do a good job with it and present something innovative for the Fresno, for Fresno and its future, but not necessarily to go out and develop it immediately. It was meant to hold some space. And I would have to tell you, the biggest awakening for me and what really started my, not so much the direct opposition, but at least a lot of questioning, was when we started to do the background studies for the new general plan update. And that's actually where I went to the city of Fresno in the first place, was to actually help with the general plan. Didn't get a chance to do that until really 2009. The SEDA history was, got started, did public meetings, and then it dies right when the Great Recession starts. And the city's going into fiscal emergency, actually an official fiscal emergency in 2010. But believe me, they went through reserves so fast that this thing probably didn't have a chance. And the cost of infrastructure then was an issue. But when we started looking at the city of Fresno from the comprehensive general plan perspective, we saw a city that really was having some serious problems with poverty, and a lot of neglected neighborhoods, a lot of issues in terms of environment and opportunity. And that's all in the 2014 general plan. It's pretty clear that's where we were going. And I would have to say that it was a combination of having a deeper understanding through detailed studies and thinking about what kind of general plan do we need to balance growth, not totally aborting any exogenous or horizontal expansion, but getting it balanced with infill and reinvestment in the existing city. And I think the general plan explains that was my project in a way. I was the project manager until I handed it off right to. And what I want to say, just an aside, Ashley Swearingen was a critical piece of this puzzle. She saw the benefit of the balanced growth plan. She let us run with our analyses and our alternatives analysis and all the things that came up with that new general plan. I hope I answered your question. It's probably growing in awareness and being more aware of what our growth model had actually done to our existing city in a lot of detailed analysis.
And it's interesting that you say that, Keith, because I remember at that time, in full disclosure for our audience, so Keith actually used to be my boss when I worked at City Hall many years ago as a baby planner. And one of the planners actually recently shared a picture of me at a community meeting for SEDA in 2007, where I was leading a workshop. So I like worked on this plan almost 2 decades ago. And I just remember working at City Hall, and at the si same time that we're talking to Peter Calthorpe and his team and planning this new urbanist utopia on the East Side, the Brookings Institution had just recently come out with a report that said that Fresno had the highest rate of concentrated poverty in the US, even after a post-Katrina New Orleans. And so, like, how did people at that time grapple with this, let's grow, let's build. We were in a boom, let's build as much suburban housing as we can, with, oh, we might be leaving a lot of neighborhoods behind in the process.
I think it kind of had to be worked out in real time with everybody. And I'm not saying that we had it right from the beginning. I think that part of this was, if you go back to the early aughts, Fresno was growing at over 2%. And honestly, there wasn't enough of anything. And I remember going into the Great Recession, we had 200 subdivision maps that had been approved. Thousands, maybe 10 or 12, 10,000 or 12,000 or 13,000 lots. This thing was just rolling, right? And then all of a sudden it reaches to a halt. And maybe we just got the time to look at the reality of what our growth model had done over the previous 6 decades. But it certainly convinced me that we needed a balanced general plan. So that's where I went into more comprehensive general planning, being more aware of the kind of infill. And that's where we came up with the idea of the activity centers and the corridors and infill and mixed use and those kinds of things. And honestly, we were achieving through that general plan the same kind of smart growth that Calthorpe had brought in concept to the area east of Temperance.
So you mentioned quickly about the growth rate and how that's changed population growth rate for Fresno. We used to grow at 2 to 3% a year. Now we're potentially at 0.2% over the next couple of decades. Could you explain this more and why we're seeing such a massive shift in our population, in our sort of projected population growth trends?
Yeah, there's been some studies by the state, and I shared them with a number of people. There's one study of population in Fresno County specifically between 1970 and 2022. And our county, because they didn't have a details for the city, but our county grew at 1.75% compounded for 52 years, right? 52 years. The state has been paying more attention to the changes in mortality, changes in birth rates, which have been dropping off a cliff for every demographic group, changes in in-migration, changes in out-migration. They came out with a series in the summer of 23 to 2060, which basically said state is plateaued. It's not going to grow. It's 39.5 million in 2020. It's 39.5 million in 2060. And they caught hell because they showed LA County going down. A lot of politics occurred because of that. Then they came out with another series in the summer of 24. And to get over some of the acrimony, they extended the projection to 2070. That 2070 projection, I was on the phone for a half hour with the Department of Finance just this week. That projection is still very valid. In fact, it may be even a little too positive. There's been a bump. Yeah, there's been a bump because of the US Census adding some immigrant population. They undercounted that came in for asylum seeking and spread out across the United States. And they allocated to states. The Department of Finance did their own research on that, accepted some of that allocation. But now what they're looking at is a border that's closed, and they're looking at net negative deportation. And honestly, they're thinking that it's at least this plateauing and then it lurches over. So my sense is that we need to look forward and understand how demography works and how population projections work in science. The little blip that you saw, and the city was more than eager to let us know about last week, this 0.8% growth between January of 24 and January 25, That happens to be a separate series. DOF sends out a housing unit survey. And they say, how many single family, how many multiple family, how many did you build and occupied, how many did you take away and destroy? And then they apply an occupancy factor to that, and they came up with that little blip. It's totally a supply number. It's not a demand factor you can extrapolate into the future. It's certainly different than the science of demography. So I would suggest if you look around the world, China's going down, South Korea's going down, Asia's going down, Europe's going down. We may have, with our immigration policy, we're probably starting to roll over in the whole United States, let alone California being in trouble. The only places that are really growing are India and Africa and some places in South America. This is a global thing.
Keith, let me ask you, I heard a lot of stuff anecdotally during the early years of COVID about expats from the Bay Area and Southern California moving here. Was that just anecdata or did we see any fluctuations during that time period?
No, I think that's real. I think you're going to see movement around. And obviously, Fresno presents an opportunity. It does present an opportunity to buy quite a bit of house for a lot less money than you would pay in the Bay Area or Southern California. So that's going to be a natural thing, in my opinion. And I don't think that's not happening. I think but you have to look at the longer term. When you're investing billions of dollars, you got to pay back. If you're borrowing money to extend billions of dollars in infrastructure, you better know what your population demand is going further. And that's all I'm saying. I think those numbers would say, be more prudent. Do the extra analysis. Make sure you're making good decisions.
That's a good segue into the next topic, which is many opponents of SATA, including yourself, many others. It's been something we've reported on, have talked about the massive infrastructure price tag that comes with building out SATA. And we saw, or we heard from Dyer last week, a quote of just $1.5 billion for the water and sewer alone. And sorry, I'm just looking at my questions for a second. Could you contextualize this conundrum that the city has? Because I think a lot of people don't fully understand when they think about SATA, they think about why wouldn't we want to build if there's people who want to, we have a housing crisis. We know that increasing supply is a way to address the housing crisis. Help us contextualize the infrastructure cost of that and why there might be some pushback to that. Let's just build.
So let me intervene with one perspective on the housing crisis. And one of the councilmen who was offering a lot of questions and perspectives on this at last week's workshop brought this up, and we're well aware. If you're going to grow into a growth area, you're also processing a plan right now, the city is, called the West Area Neighborhoods. West Area Neighborhoods is that area north of Clinton, west of 99, all the way to the edge of the Spear, right, going west. It has capacity for 50,000 units of new greenfield development. And I'm assuming maybe 10,000 units of city infill. That particular growth area specific plan actually has 42,000 city residents already. And they're just now getting some infrastructure through Veterans Boulevard. And they need, whether they grow anymore or not, they need a very big interchange on Shaw and 99, on and on. That's 50,000 units plus. And then the housing element that the city developed in coordination with the Housing and Community Development Department of the state of California, very conservative, is estimating, very conservative, that the infill existing parcels inside the city limits has a capacity of at least 40,000 units. I think it's probably double that, but they're being conservative. West area, infill is 90,000 units. You've got plans already that will help you with the housing crisis. You don't necessarily need to build east of Temperance to meet the housing crisis. I just want to say that out loud. So with
Can
regard
also...
to the... Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go.
When you go to the public facilities financing plan, which is kind of the technical term for how much sewer, water, streets, roads, fire stations, you know, all that you need. We think the total build out, and this is the difference, phasing and then build out, right? The city's already said in the EIR, the state EIR, that they're looking at two phases, maybe 15,000 units in phase one and the rest of it in phase two. If you look at a build out cost, it's probably well over $4 billion in today's dollars. I think what the mayor was referring to is they're starting to slice this thing down so that you don't have the sticker shock. And they're looking at North SATA and they're saying, oh my gosh, even building north of 180, is probably $1.5 billion for that infrastructure. And he said it, it's too much to bear to put on the rate papers. They'll be paying for it forever. And the other thing is, if the population does start to roll over sooner, then they have bonding obligations. They got to pay interest on or default, right? So they'll pay those. Who takes the shortness? city ratepayers. You don't get as much investment back in the city, right? So this is a zero-sum game at some point if you finance it, right? So I would say it's how you slice and dice the infrastructure extension you're talking about. And I think they're doing it in phasing. And I would also suggest, just for the record, the phasing analysis in their EIR is non-existent.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about recouping costs through sales tax, property taxes? That's just such a long runway on that. And then we're just uncertain of where the project's success. You have to do this upfront costs, and then you're uncertain of revenue afterwards. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Let me say there's two kind of aspects to this. One is the capital improvement aspect, which would be the putting that new infrastructure out there and making it the land available to be developed. So they're moving all this big infrastructure, arterial roadways, right? Trunk lines for sewer and big water mains and storm drainage. All this stuff has to be put into place right to a parcel line so that the developer then can build on that, put their underground in another parcel, and then hook into the major infrastructure, right? That is something the city would finance on the front end to get it into place, and then they would get paid back as building permits are taken out in those areas. Are you with me? So that's paying back the capital through fees and things like that that are related to that bonding capacity and making that infrastructure advance, or advancing an infrastructure out there. They borrow the money, they get it there, and then they get paid over time. The risk in that, of course, is that you don't have the demand that you're forecasting, and you may have stranded assets.
Can we just point out an example of where that happened? Do you remember the fire station west of 99 that was in a tract home for 10 years, 15 years? A lot of building happened in the 2000s west of 99 in the west area. Part of this was in the west area, but then the crash happened and they didn't have enough financing to build a fire station to serve all those homes. So they literally retrofitted a tract home into a fire station for like almost 15 years until the city found general fund money. So all of our tax dollars from everywhere else in the city, not just the residents that live out there, to be able to build a $3 million fire station, whatever it ended up being.
Great example. So you have this extending the infrastructure, making land developable, right? And then you get paid back for that extension. The borrowings get paid back over time as people take out building permits and they live there. The property tax and the sales tax, though, is a different thing. And we've asked now for several years, and there were several of us that were part of the General Plan Implementation Review Committee that started in 2019, got interrupted because of COVID, and then it re-established. Like 70 motions were made by this very diverse committee. One that got through was the city needed to do a comprehensive fiscal impact analysis and develop a tool that the staff could use to assess the impact of building out these specific plan areas in the general plan. That tool's been built. It's capable. That's not been used to assess SATA. I believe it's been used to assess the West area back in 22, somewhere in that neighborhood. That's not been made public. That assesses the impact of the development and all the services the city has to supply at some level of service, which is a qualification, right? A quantity of service, police, fire, all kinds of stuff, and figures out what's the impact on the general fund departments. That's operating. So the public facilities plan is capital, getting paid back for extending the capital. The comprehensive fiscal impact analysis is assessing on an ongoing basis, long-term, you build this thing out. You've taken on all the responsibility for all the services. Are you breaking even? Are you losing money? You see the difference? We need both. I think in this time of real tumult, shifting paradigms, the global economy, population, all these things, you want to take a little time and be really prudent to use all the numbers you can to figure out whether you're actually buying more than you need, or you shouldn't even do it at all because you really should redirect those resources towards resiliency and fiscal sustainability of the existing city. They already have 550,000 customers that they're responsible for.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about some of the arguments for SATA that are pretty prominent. One of them, the biggest one probably, is that Fresno is losing housing competition to Madera County, to Clovis. Developers really want to build in high performing school districts like Clovis Unified, and to a lesser extent in Jordan. What's the school district in Madera?
Sanger.
Madera Unified, and then there's Golden Valley.
And Golden Valley. They want to build in Golden Valley in particular. And so I'm curious if you could respond to that market reality. That's what the elected officials are hearing. We don't really care that you're opening up all this capacity in the West area because it's not Clovis Unified.
See, those are the kinds of things that I think need to be debated. But let me go back. You can accommodate certain market preferences, but can you afford to?
Yeah.
It's kind of, I really want that big house, but can I afford it? And all we're suggesting is we're not trying to deny that people want to be in Sanger Unified, Clovis Unified, that they want to live east, they don't want to live west, and all those kinds of things. But when it gets down to brass tacks, what can you actually afford? And can we at least answer that question first so that your preferences can be financed?
Yeah.
That's how I would respond.
And no, I know. Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, Danielle. I just want to say this one thing. It could very well be, and all I hear is we're not getting the property tax. We're not getting the property tax. For every dollar of property tax you get, are you paying 90 cents? Are you paying $1.10?
Yeah. Keith, I've got a question. This is something that Donnie and I have gone back and forth a little bit on. We've covered over the last year all the challenges in actually implementing infill housing in Fresno. And so if we're talking about a housing crisis, the alternative that I'm often pitched by people is, oh, just need more infill housing. And then I go back to all of our reporting on how incredibly hard it is to get that done. And so it just feels saying no to SEDA, but saying yes to something that has been elusive feels like just a quagmire. What am I missing there?
So I don't think you have to frame it as a zero sum. You do have some expansion area for a period of time in the West area. And honestly, they're building $700,000 homes over there. I've driven by them. I have somebody that I know very well that bought a $600,000 house. They're building some nice homes out there. They're very nice homes, okay? So there is that starting to happen west of 99. They do need better crossings. They need to be able to get into town easier and not have to wait for 10 lights to get across Shaw and that sort of thing. But it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. And we're not saying there shouldn't be a build-out here and there. And we're not even saying there shouldn't be parts of SEDA longer term. We're saying when you look at the whole thing, have you done the analysis you need to make? As far as infill goes, this is just my opinion. I really believe that when I talk to some of the developers who have tried, they get so caught up in the permitting process and they find out so late some of the expensive contingencies for some of the infill. And it's just more expensive to infill. Let's just say it really is more expensive for the developer. But if you could start to really seriously streamline some of the permitting and have the city identify some of the parcels that they use to do the calculation in the housing amount and say, let's preference some of these parcels and see if these guys, the owners really want to change. Let's go in and get the offsite infrastructure done. And then you're just plugging and playing. But the problem is on infill, you run into all kinds of infrastructure deficiencies. That developer has to fix it for everybody in the neighborhood. Are you with me? So you're right. It's more difficult. But I would venture to say, if you look at tax sharing agreements between the city of Fresno and the county over a long period of time, man, if you develop on our corridors and you develop downtown, you get a lot more than 51%, right? So ultimately, the fiscal reward is there. All I would suggest is Fresno, again, in my opinion, needs to have a more balanced approach, and it needs to have a bunch of people working on how do I get these parcels developed? What infrastructure advance do I need to give to infill parcels as well as infrastructure advance to greenfield?
But there's also, I hear what you're saying about streamlining the process. And I've talked to a lot of infill developers who will cite just absurd things that happen in the process. And that feels partially like a culture shift at City Hall in some ways, in terms of how they think about approaching infill. And like you said, not putting the infrastructure burden of the neighborhood on one project. But there is this other issue, which is that we just don't have that many developers trying to do this. And there's two. Or three. And when you talk to a lot of people in the development and real estate community, they'll just say, why would I build in Fresno Unified? Darius Assemi is banging that drum at GV Wire constantly. Like, why would we build in a poor performing school district? And yet that doesn't seem to hamper developers in Oakland or Long Beach, Los Angeles. So what makes it different here?
I think we're in this with infill, we're still in the chicken and egg stage. And I feel like I've heard some stories from really credible builders who said, I got down the road on this permitting process and they kept giving me things to do and my pro forma changed. It was skinny anyway, and then it flipped over and I couldn't do the project. So part of this is advancing the knowledge about what are the constraints and things that have to be mitigated to actually use some of these parcels. The bigger thing to me is, and I still love the book, The Regional City, step up, go up in elevation a little bit for a minute and look at the four counties. It's almost 2 million people now. Here's Fresno, which has the bones to be the regional city, but a lot of people don't want to come here because a lot of they don't like the urban decay and blight. They don't like the feeling of being vulnerable, even though the crime rate isn't really that bad. They don't like that feeling. And I feel like if you're looking at small entrepreneurs, you're looking at protecting these schools, you're looking at protecting these neighborhoods and investing in them over time, you could have this city that is a magnet. You've already got the position of being the governmental center for four counties, the education center for four counties, the medical center for four counties, and you could be the entertainment center. And that gives you a bump up in the ability to attract dollars of investing in a bunch of things. And somehow we're not getting to that critical mass. You look at downtown, there are heroes down there trying to turn that thing. And if we could, I think you've got a service area, a market area that really could facilitate a lot here. But if you let it continue to decay because of the kind of attitudes we're talking about, or not getting the permit streamlining and the city investing in infrastructure in the existing city limits the way they could maybe, I think you will lose it eventually. And that would just be so sad because Fresno really, to me, I should have started this off. I love Fresno. I think it has enormous potential, or I wouldn't even say a word about it.
So you're part of what you're saying is it's a perception problem.
But yeah. Also a real
and,
problem.
Yeah.
No, it's real. It's real and perceptual. I'll be candid. I was working with somebody on the west side of the county. And they said, we like Clovis, but we hate driving through that jungle of Fresno to get there. I'm saying, are you kidding me? But that was real for them.
Yeah.
As a person, you worked obviously in Keith for many decades on this issue, and I'm stuck because I feel like when I graduated from college 20 years ago and moved back to Fresno, we were still having this conversation about, oh, if we could just change the perception. What has, maybe a way to ask this is, what has improved and what's gotten worse? What's working?
I think a lot has improved. I mean, if you drive around the Fresno High neighborhood, look at that 35 years ago. And how it was starting to get a little seedy on the edges in some places. Now it's absolutely wonderful. Now, maybe that's called gentrification. I don't mean to get into that particular discussion, but I just feel like Fresno's got this enormous, beautiful set of bones. And it's got these great older neighborhoods that some of them are having some challenges now, some other neighborhoods that really need to be elevated. Lowell is starting to get there, but it's gonna take a long time. And if we did that and people really felt good about it, I think we could be that regional city. And I think the economic, that's what everybody's looking for. What's the economic part of this? How does it create economic development? I think that would be the key to that. If we don't do that, we're just, to me, playing the competing suburbs game, and we're letting kind of the trunk of the tree wither. And to me, Danielle, Jordan, this is a never-ending battle. It's never-ending. It's always going to be there. And it just has to be a lot of people on the case. I don't know how you do this, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, which has been left behind for a lot of reasons the last 50 years. And it just needs to make some stands on certain things. I just hope Fresno can preserve its competitive advantage because it really has one. It just needs to actually act to make that come to fruition.
We hear a lot of national narratives, how to fix things. And none of them seem to really specifically apply to here. In this past 2 months, we've got this new book from Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson.
Abundance.
And they have some prescriptions in there, but they don't really seem to square our circle here that is Fresno. And so we have a lot of people, I feel like, on the outside saying, here's your solution. We developed it 200 miles north of you and we're going to drop it off. And then we kind of look around and say, didn't we try that? And so I think there's, I don't know really what I'm asking here. I'm just venting maybe.
Well, no, but I think it's a combination of things. So I want to elevate the DRIVE initiative from Central Valley Community Foundation. That's only 6 years old. And it has so much potential to engage so many more thousands of people in the civic process. We've got a number of churches and unions working together in different associations. We've got some place-based CDCs, things we didn't even have 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, that I think are part of the DNA of the future. And I really believe that as they get more vision and capability, they'll begin to influence some of the policy and the resource allocations. But honestly, if you look at where we were 10 years ago with that kind of DNA, it was almost non-existent.
Yeah. I want to ask and maybe revisit a question that Jordan posed, which is, this it feels a little bit like we're at a stalemate at times between, developers want to sprawl for the most part. We are trying to push them towards alternatives that are not quite viable for a variety of reasons. And yet our housing crisis, our affordable housing crisis is escalating. I think the figure in Fresno County varies between 35 and 40,000 units of affordable housing short to meet the demand. So how do we address that demand in the interim while we're figuring out how to make infill more achievable?
Yeah, I think there is potential to meet some of that need in the existing city limits. And you might have to do some edges in a West Area neighborhood. And if somebody said, we're not going to approve 9,000 acres, but we're going to approve 500 acres and get 4,000 houses built in a mix or something like that, I think a lot of us would go, maybe it's time to do that. Maybe it's time to do that. But that's not what we hear. We see these really open-ended things that could be quite deleterious if, in fact, they get started. So you just really want to be prudent about that. So I guess it would be a little bit smaller, have all the guys that are going to build it all together, and they say they're going to build it. A lot of this stuff is speculative, right? We don't know if anybody's going to build anything, but we know we'd have to put a lot of financing in place to see if they will or won't, right? So there's speculation, there's prudence. I'm not against building good suburbs. I was telling somebody the other day, I really wish we could resolve this thing about the industrial triangle and the freeways and the railroads, and have really tracked advanced manufacturing and assembly and logistics that really create higher paying jobs. And if we got a big corporate headquarters, we want to move here, and they said, we don't have the housing we want, I'd say, go build it for them. Let's have some nice, do it. But this also maybe part of this, and I didn't say that earlier, is let's tie maybe our economic development strategies to a housing strategy instead of housing be the industry. And it really, our suburban housing has been the industry for the last 70 years for the most part. It's been our industry.
We close these podcasts in the same way each week with what we're loving this week. I'm going to start with you, Keith. Keith, what are you loving this week? Books, movies, anything jump out to you this week?
Let me get real personal. My wife woke me up at 3 a.m. this morning because our 8-year-old grandson lives with us during the week, and my wife is amazing, helping this kid go to school and get the most out of school. And he'd been running around our backyard last night and somehow got a hold of something that caused an allergy. His throat was swelling closed, and he had these kind of welts from this. So I was at the Winco at 3 in the morning buying children's Benadryl and getting that home to grandma so this kid, and really he took it. 10 minutes later, he was good, went to sleep. I love that part of my life, being a grandpa and having a kid that I love. And I love my wife. And I think that's what I'm loving. I'm loving my family.
That's wonderful. Donnie, what about you? What are you loving this week?
I'm not loving that Steph Curry has a strained hamstring for the NBA playoffs, but I generally love NBA playoff season.
Yes.
So,
Speak to me. Go on.
conflicted answer. Yes, my household is a strong Warriors household. And it's a nice time to come together with my husband's family. So we spend a ton of time with family during NBA playoffs every May and June, as long as the Warriors are in the playoffs. So I enjoy that. Lots of family, lots of potlucks and parties. And let's see Steph Curry healed.
Yes, please. Lots knocking on every piece of wood in my house for that. What I'm loving this week is maybe a little bit counterintuitive. Typically, when it starts to get hot around the Central Valley, there's a sense of dread that you feel as summer approaches. But for me, I love floating on the San Joaquin River. So as soon as it gets warm, I start thinking about my rafts in my garage, my raft that I have that's just for an ice chest, which is one of my favorite components. And so, if you've never, lots of people around here have floated the Kings River and Reedley, that's really common. Not many people float the San Joaquin River, which I feel like I'm giving away a secret here, but it's a great thing to know about. I float from Friant Dam all the way down Lost Lake, and it's one of my favorite summer activities. And it's free and usable, and you pay $5 to park at Lost Lake and have a great time. And it doesn't feel as hot when your legs are sitting in a glacial runoff. It really doesn't. It really balances your equilibrium. So that's what I'm loving this week.
Good recommendation.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.